Hi, welcome to We Mentor Mondays podcast with Nancy. Get inspired, break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery. Learn something new from our stories today. Welcome to this Monday's mentoring session. I have in front of me John Munger. Hi, John.
Hello.
John is the executive director of the Lopet Foundation, and we are just finishing up the Lopet Festival. Is that accurate?
Yep, it was just a week ago. Yep.
Okay. And do you want to share a little bit about what the festival is all about?
The Lopet Festival is a celebration of winter in Minneapolis, and it ranges from everything from ski races and ski marathons to ski joring where a dog is pulling you while you're skiing to dog sledding and ice biking and fat tire biking on the snow and snow sculptures. And there's a lot of different things, elements to it.
Yeah. We went for the first time, Matthew, Olivia, and I, on Lake of the Isles to the Luminary Lopet.
Which is the biggest part of our event.
Wow, thousands of people. How many thousands were there this year?
We sell about, 7,500, 8,000 tickets, and there are a number of other people as well, so it's probably 10,000, 12,000 people.
Okay. Yeah, and there was a band there this year, and hot chocolate, and the beer line.
In fact, one of the worst parts of the event this year was that we ran out of beer that evening.
Okay. Well, the weather was perfect. You have buses taking people in. We rode the bus from Golden Valley to downtown Minneapolis, and that worked slick.
Good.
Yeah,
well, that's what we want to hear. Yeah, there's not enough parking up there, so keeping those buses rolling is important.
Yeah, and you didn't wait long on the buses either. For driving us down there, it was maybe 10 minutes, and then when we did the walk around Lake of the Isles, and then I think next year Olivia said that she's ready to bring a group of friends to do the skiing together.
Oh, good. Excellent.
Yeah, a little more planning. But the weather was perfect, and it was like 10 minutes when we were ready to go, and the bus was ready to take off.
Good. Yeah. Good. That's what we want to hear.
So one of the things that I'm, in doing a little bit more research about you, just to let our audience know that your daughter Ellie and my daughter Olivia were in soccer together on a soccer team a few years ago, and that's kind of how I kept running into you a little bit. And then our neighbor works with you for building buildings on the Worth Park.
The Andersons are volunteers, and their kids are on the Lopet skiing, involved in Lopet skiing activities, and Willie's a big part of the team that builds the Luminary Lopet, so they're all in with what we do.
Yeah, that's excellent. All right. Well, in preparation for today, I have this book that I ran across that kind of fits with the work that you're doing. And the book was written in 2000 or published in 2012 by Tony Wagner. He also wrote The Global Achievement Gap, which is helping kids prepare the skills that they need for work today.
Okay.
And that book came out in 2008. And this is about creating innovators and the making of young people who will change the world. And what was intriguing and why I thought it would kind of help our discussion today is that a lot of what you're doing are the essential elements that he talks about in his book of educating young people to become innovators of what we should value. And one of those things is the value of hands-on projects,
right,
where students have to solve real problems and demonstrate mastery. And I was wondering, in your trainings, what do you think you do to provide that skill set?
With the kids that we're working with.
Yeah, because you work with kids and adults.
Yep. We worked with the full range of them. I think I think very simply, we're going into schools, you know, at its most basic and providing ski equipment and coaching, right? And you're teaching kids how to do things that most of them have had no familiarity with. You know, they might be, their family background might be from Africa or Mexico or Laos, and there's just no family background of doing the skiing. So
they haven't been in warm climates.
They're cold climates. Yes, right. Exactly. Yeah, you don't have a chance to cross-country ski in Laos or Mexico too often, or even see snow. So what the kids learn from that is, you know, is the skiing, but it is really this sense that they can master something that they're unfamiliar with. And I think that sense carries over to many other aspects of what they do. You see it when, so our programs, those particular ones, we call them the mini Lopet programs. We bus the kids to our Lopet festival at the end of it.
Yeah.
And there you see them all ski, and it's in a non-competitive event, and they all get a medal at the end. And you can just see their mind spinning and saying to themselves, boy, this is something that society values. I've learned to do this. I can do other things.
Yeah.
And that sense is really what we're trying to get them to learn. Not so much the skiing, as that this is their key to doing, you know, other things in life. They can master things.
Yeah.
Excellent. Good at it. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, what I noticed in the reading is there one of the skills to develop an innovator is the importance of learning to draw on academic content from multiple disciplines to solve a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about teaching students new things and the elements of being outdoors and really challenging them to work together, also teamwork is really important. How does that aspect of innovation kind of show up when you're with kids on the outside?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I personally think of that as being a big part of my life, is drawing from different aspects of things.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, increasingly in our schools today, you know, we're really focused on, quote unquote, the basics, right? You know, what's 3 + 3? What's 4 + 4? How do you spell whatever? And I think that kind of broad liberal artsy type of view of the world, where you know, it is good to learn how to cross country ski or go mountain biking, and or for that matter, just being out in nature,
yeah.
I think is really an important and kind of becoming increasingly forgotten element of what's important in innovation. You know, they talk a lot about how this kind of rigid world that we have kids in, where they're indoors a lot, where they're looking at screens a lot, you're missing some of the richness of the world, some of the kind of randomness of the natural world that I think really does carry over to these drawing upon different things in order to innovate type of ideas. So
absolutely.
And then in our programs, you know, we really try to have kids go out together. You know, we have some programs that are really focused on competition, but many of them are just focused on being out there together, and you're playing capture the flag together, and you're on a team together. You're all trying to get from point A to point B together, and you're working on how you're going to accomplish that. And some kids are better at one part than another, and so they're all trying to figure that out and help each other out. And I think those things are helping build that teamwork that ultimately will result in more innovation later on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've seen that kind of show up in your background a little bit, and I would like to kind of delve into that a little
sure.
bit. So how are you feeling right now? John, like everyone that I interview and mentor, filled out the self-awareness mentoring journal just before we got on the mics. And so he's prepared to talk about his emotional state right now.
I am, I'm very much not a linear emotional person. I'm very up and down emotionally, and I was just thinking earlier today that I'm in a very good emotional state. I'll give you an example. I spoke last night up in Duluth, and my parents live up there, and so I stayed overnight, and this morning I cross-country skied in Jay Cook State Park on my way home, and And I didn't see a soul out on the trail. I saw wolf tracks on the trail as I was skiing along. And I thought to myself that I just felt reconnected to who I am as a person and not so much in the kind of the rush that I think many people get into. I mean, doing the Lopet Festival takes all of me and all of our whole staff and more in order to make it happen. And you can kind of lose sight of who you are. And so I feel very kind of connected with myself right now, if that makes any sense.
Yes, absolutely. So you're feeling pretty good and grounded and, in yourself.
Yep. And we had a successful Lopet Festival, as we've talked about. And you know, they've all been successful in their own way, but it's very nice for us. Unfortunately, the weather plays a big role in our emotional state, and it snowed for us, and we were able to put on the event that we really wanted to, so that I think we all feel really good about.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit more about like where you grew up and how big of a family you grew up in?
Sure.
And some of your interests as a child?
So I grew up in Southwest Minneapolis, and I have a brother and a sister, both younger than me. I grew up following my older neighbor boys around who happened to be very, very talented runners, and that got me interested in, in running type of things. They were also into playing Strat-O-Matic baseball. You're making me think of things I hadn't thought of in a while.
Strat-O-Matic?
Yeah, Strat-O-Matic baseball.
What's
is
that?
A game where you rolled dice. At the time, you rolled dice, and the statistics were all based on what the previous year's statistics in the baseball season were. So if you played a season of Strat-O-Matic baseball with a dice, your players would come out with the same averages about that they had during the regular season. What it promoted for me was, I think it really helped me get this sense of being a math person. You know, later on, I ended up becoming a math major in college, and so that was an interest that was, whatever. It's something that came about. But anyway, running was an interest, and math became an interest. And then, I've seen you kind of point to this. My dad, at one point when I was, I think, 11, was running the Multiple Sclerosis Society. And his job was to be a fundraiser. But he didn't really like raising money that much.
Okay.
At least asking people for money. So he would come up with ideas for how to raise money without asking people for money.
Okay.
And he had been from Duluth, so he came up with this idea that maybe he could get people to ride their bikes from Minneapolis to Duluth, and then have them ask their friends for money as to sponsor them on their ride.
That's brilliant, right?
Yes. And so one day he put a backpack on, and we got on our bikes and rode our bikes to Duluth when I was 11 to see whether ordinary people could, ride their bikes to Duluth.
154 and a half miles.
I guess that's what it is, yeah. Yes. So by the third day, I was pretty beat down, and but we made it through, and that was how the MS-150 started, but that was also how a big interest of mine in biking and later on just endurance sports generally started.
Yeah, I had read a blog you describing a little bit about that event, and I thought that your dad's technique of getting you to keep going was kind of pretty. It worked.
Yes. Yeah, we were on the third day of the trip, because the first day we just made it to, I think, White Bear Lake, because we'd left late in the afternoon. And we went to Hinckley, and the third day I was beat tired, but we were on Highway 23, which isn't that hilly now, but when you're an 11-year-old who's on the third day of a trip, it was like going through the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah.
So every time we would be climbing a hill, I would start crying, and every time my dad would say, well, I think this is it. After this hill, it's 5-mile hill down into Duluth, and We would crest the hill, and there would just be another hill going up, and I would cry some more. And you know, you're right. He got me through the day. But eventually, we got to Five Mile Hill and made it into town.
So I was thinking, my daughter, when she was, I think about 8, we biked around Medicine Lake.
Yep.
And I just remember her, like, you know, I was feeling like a really bad parent because we didn't pack enough snacks.
Yes.
So we were trying to think of ways to kind of get her through. And I wish I would have had that thinking in mind because that would have helped.
Yes.
And I was thinking when I read this, if this would have happened to me, I don't know if I would have kept going, like, you know, or like kept in sports. But you really took that experience, and it seemed like it started your love of endurance sports. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, I think you raise a point that I think is really important, is that everything doesn't have to be fun in order to be meaningful, right? I mean, you get through with that, and I'm an 11-year-old kid. I'm really proud of the fact that I biked to Duluth, and people are saying, wow, you biked to Duluth, and you get this sense of validation, and I really try and carry that over to what we do for work now. I mean, certainly we try and make some of the things that we're doing fun.
Yes.
But it's not all about fun. Sometimes hard work pays off in more meaningful ways than just going out and doing something that's quote unquote fun all the time. And you see that when kids have struggled, when they're maybe not doing so well, that's often the prelude to the most meaningful things in their life, because they'll finally overcome and do better.
Yeah.
And that's what really makes a difference.
Yeah. And so the memory that you're creating during that experience is what sticks with you.
Right, right. And that sense of accomplishment. You know, when you finally do overcome what's, you know, a big obstacle.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. Okay. Remender. You still run, ski, and bike?
Yep. Yep.
Okay. And you have continued that throughout your life. That's been an ongoing theme?
Yes. Yep. It really has. I bet you I've never gone more than 3 days in a row since I was 15 years old without running or biking or skiing.
Wow. And maybe is that the reason why you have minimal injuries?
I mean, you know, I mix it up. I very rarely will run every day. And if I do run, I'm on trails, and skiing, you get very few injuries, and biking as well. But yeah, if you stick with things over time, I do think it's when you aren't doing things for a long time and then start up all of a sudden and go big and run a marathon or something, yeah, you're going to get injured for sure.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. And your whole family, right? Your wife, Diana, she is big into sports, and Lauren and Ellie too?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My wife is a family practice physician, and when I met her, she was an obsessive swimmer. She had some eating issues at the time, which, you know, she's really overcome. But what has stayed with her is this idea of really getting exercise every day. So I go out and do something every day, a half an hour, an hour, whatever. She does a couple hours every day.
Okay.
So she's a great example setter for the world on that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how do you think endurance sport participation has informed your leadership decisions, how you set your goal-setting abilities, how you manage your time, and how you raise money?
You know, the only thing that I kind of really feel like I'm good at in doing the work I do is perseverance.
Okay. Well, that's important.
I think perseverance and endurance sports are really related. You know, you're not going to be good at endurance sports without persevering, and you're not doing endurance sports unless you're persevering. And so that sense of just kind of keep on going and get up every morning and go back to work has really informed everything I've done.
Okay. So, like, how, and has it helped you in managing your time well?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, increasingly, I think time management issues that I observe in other people, and in myself as well, have to do with all the distractions there are in the world now, right? I mean,
yeah,
you know,
right.
It's to do a couple hours of actually focused work on writing something or analyzing some issue, whatever, is actually hard to do these days because there's cell phones and there's, you know, text messages and Twitter and Facebook and all these this information coming at you all the time. And I think that sense that, you know, okay, when I go out for a run, I'm running and I run for an hour or whatever, and that's all I'm doing. I try and bring that same focus to the office. And so
I see.
I feel like it's not so much the volume of activity, but it's how much, or of work, but it's how much, you know, you actually spend time focusing and getting it done, knocking it off, as opposed to just kind of doing little bits and pieces, which is, I think, you know, kind of a problem that all of us have to some degree.
Yeah. When it sounds like you have some strategies that seem to work for you.
Yeah. I think that focus time and that, you know, and it is very similar to, and I think a lot of the same skills that you get from the, you know, being out in the world. And the other part of it that I think relates there is, you know, when you go out and you do your run or your ski or your bike or whatever it is, you come back in and you're far more ready to tackle a focused project.
And sit.
Yeah. And sit and it's all, and you're not constantly fidgeting because you've
oh, right.
gotten the energy out. And this goes back to a point we were making earlier. I think the natural world calms the mind. It gets the clutter out and the agitation out. I have a job that sounds really fun and your job is about going cross country skiing. The reality is that it can be very, very frustrating and very, very politically charged, and I need to have that outlet to clear my mind. Otherwise, you know, I would kind of boil over on any number, and I unfortunately do boil over occasionally. Avoid that by going and getting the energy out and kind of refocusing your mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Very good. So when you, and how have you come to terms with raising money? Did you feel like your dad found himself raising money for multiple sclerosis, but created an activity, you know, that was very, you know, innovative in how he was problem solving a dilemma that he found himself in?
Well, I think, you know, I'm lucky in that, you know, I started this organization. I didn't start it to raise money, right? But I started it because it's all things that I really believe in, and I think my dad believed in, you know, multiple sclerosis society. It's, you know, it's a great thing, but it's a job that he was hired into, and I kind of feel like I believe so strongly in what we do and the influence that it has and can have and how meaningful it can be that it's not that hard for me to ask for money because I feel like I'm generally doing the person I'm asking a favor by asking them.
Okay.
Because I'm giving them an opportunity to do something really meaningful in life. And that's not just in the fundraising and money side of it, but also in volunteering. We ask people to do really, you know,
a lot of time,
a lot of their energy. And I generally feel good about it because the worst I've ever had is people saying, you know, no, no one's ever, you know, bit my head off or anything. And a lot of times I have people come back to me and say, thank you for giving me the opportunity to be involved. This is such a meaningful part of my life. So it's been actually easier and easier over time on that front.
Yeah, because you're seeing over the years the long-term effects of what you're doing.
Yep, you see the long-term effects, and you see the long-term effects on the people that are in the organization. I mean, as volunteers, they're, you know, I'll see them and they have a bumper sticker on for the LOPIT, or they have their Facebook header picture is a picture of them doing something with a LOPIT or wearing a LOPIT hat or whatever it is. And it gives you the sense that this is a big part of their identity. So that feels good and maybe helps them encourage me even more to ask even more.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. Tell us a little bit about how you you founded the LOPIT Foundation. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Okay. And
Jump in on that. There's a lot of help from a lot of other people.
Okay. But how's the LOPIT Foundation different than like the City of Lakes LOPIT?
Oh, okay.
Like, so you were the race director for for that organization for a while.
So the City of Lakes LOPIT is the name of our winter festival.
Oh, I see.
Right?
Okay.
And initially, when we first got started, maybe I'll just tell that little story.
Yes.
Yeah. So R.T. Rybak had come into office as mayor. Of Minneapolis, mm-hmm. Yep. And after he came into office, he had gone and done the American Birkebeiners ski marathon up in Wisconsin. And on his way back from that event, him and some other people, you know, were talking in the car and said, geez, Minneapolis should, you know, really have more of the silent sports, as he put it, it should be the silent sports capital. And so he called a meeting with the park board of people interested in mountain biking and cross-country skiing and so forth. And a bunch of people showed up to that meeting. I was one of them. And a bunch of ideas came out of it. The trails should be better. We should do programming for kids. We should have an event. But after the meeting, not much happened. And so a month or so later, I got the email list from the park board folks and sent out an email and said, hey, we're going to have our first meeting to talk about this stuff. And, you know, I think two people showed up to that meeting.
Okay.
But we started working with the park board on trail stuff, and eventually we held a meeting about doing an event, at which there were three people. Bruce Adelsman, who runs skinnyski.com, a website devoted to skiing, and my 10-month-old daughter and me were the three people at that meeting.
Okay.
But we sent out a meeting or an email that night and said, hey, we had a great first meeting on this event, and we're going to meet again next week. And a few more people showed up the next week. And a few weeks later, I found myself the race director for this event that became the City of Lakes LOPIT. And after the event, we formed this nonprofit, which we called the City of Lakes Nordic Ski Foundation. And then eventually we renamed that the LOPIT Foundation to encompass kind of more of a broad mission of year-round activities.
Oh,
and the LOPIT Festival, or City of Lakes LOPIT, is one element of the LOPIT Foundation.
Okay. So you saw an opportunity that emerged, and no one was taking charge of it, and you had an idea. You saw yourself as, oh, well, I can help out with this. I can do this. I think this is important. And then out of that, things evolved into your foundation.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, I had grown up cross-country skiing at Theodore Worth Park, when I went to South High School, right? And when I was, after getting older, I had gone to law school and lived near the park, and then become an attorney and lived near the park, and just had this mounting frustration with the trails at the park, that they weren't being maintained in a way that really, you know, was as good as it could be.
Sure.
And so when this came along, I'm like, well, geez, I really want to help, you know, make sure that the trails get better. And the idea of the event was a little bit secondary at first, but but I guess I came to think of it as important. And over time, the event really became the galvanizing thing for the whole community.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness you did that, right? This is.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of good things that have come out of the foundation forming. I mean, there's over 10,000 kids that we've taught to ski and mountain bike and trail run and get them reconnected with nature. And the trails are much, much, much more robust in the park, and there's snowmaking. So when you have cruddy winters, you still have skiing. And, and people, I think, have really gotten a lot out of being involved with the organization. So there's been many good things, I think, have come out of it.
And your current project also is expanding at Worth Park?
Yep.
What's happening there?
So, as we went along, we became this organization that's doing all these things with kids, mostly in North Minneapolis, but operating out of the backs of vans and trailers and really no infrastructure. And then many of the kids that we work with are from near Worth Park, but most of the year Worth Park is mostly a golf course. And so we're trying to teach them about all these different activities they can be doing, but they're seeing different messaging when they're coming to the park. So we worked with the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board on kind of a master plan for the park.
Yeah.
That takes and moves a few of the golf holes and hopefully improves the golf course, but also has creates a space that's devoted just to these activities like skiing and mountain biking and trail running. And so we call that project the Adventure Center.
Okay.
And it has a building in it that acts as the jumping off point and kind of our home base. And I think will really be an important part of the community generally here in the Twin Cities. But that has become, the big part of my life now. The last 2.5 years we've been fundraising for it, and that's really been, where I've transitioned my role from being kind of a race director with other responsibilities to being an executive director of this organization.
Hmm. And I imagine with the Adventure Center that your legal background is really helping out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, really, everything that we've done along the way, the legal background has been really important. It's in untold ways. I mean, this goes to your point about how do you manage all the different activities? The question you had before on that. When I was an attorney, I had, 15, 20, 30 cases going at any one time. And you just flip, back and forth between the different cases and, organized your days in order to be prepared for what was coming in the, days and weeks and months ahead. And you just had to be able to go from thing to thing. And those principles have really applied to what we do now. I've never been one who said, oh, we're doing too many things, let's not do anything new now. As my staff will tell you, and it's because I kind of consider it to be there's just all different cases and different things that you're working on, and you just go from thing to thing and do your best at all of them. And so it's helped in that way. It's also helped in we deal a lot with public entities. And I did a lot of public sector law, and so I kind of know some of the ins and outs there. And there's a lot of non-lawyers in the public sector who will tell you that they can't do things because of quote-unquote liability.
Okay.
And there's nothing more powerful than having an attorney who knows the area say, what do you mean by that?
Yeah.
Whereas I think, if you ask the same question, they would just blow you off because you don't have that legal background necessarily.
Yes, right.
But with it, it's a lot of power to, because they're actually forced to answer the question. And the reality is that what they're really saying is, I don't want to do that because that's not what we've done before.
I see.
And so if you're going to be an agent of change, it's nice to be able to
have the ammunition you need to problem solve and get around the roadblocks that are there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. this sounds like a good stopping point for our listeners. And I would like to continue in another session with you, if sure. you're up for that.
Okay, yeah.
All right. So thanks, everybody, for listening. I think you've heard a lot about innovation today and the aspects of the burgeoning skills that are needed when you're becoming an innovator in your early childhood, how important those experiences are in shaping you and formulating what becomes your play, your passion, your purpose, your greater impact that you're making in life. So we'll see you next Monday. Thanks for being here, John.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.